Hello, this is Roz Friedman reading the New York Times book review. And I'm going to read several pages of crime stories reviewed by Marilyn Stacio. Who does what? Readers usually wonder about the mechanics of smoothly successful collaborations like that of Jonathan Kellerman and his son, Jesse. There are no psychologically wounded children in A Measure of Darkness, published by Ballantine, 2899, which would tip us to the hand of Kellerman Pear, but a lovely exchange between a college student and his grandmother, a homemade coconut cake as a reward for a quick visit, suggests a more youthful sensibility. As for the keen sense of drama, it must be a genetic trait. Clay Edison, an Oakland, California coroner's investigator, makes a point of performing his sleuthing duties with patience and diplomacy. Sensitive to both the living and the dead, he's gentle as he lifts the body of a transvestite dressed as an angel onto a gurney, noting that she felt like nothing, like the body of a bird, hollow bones and down. Her death was the result of a party that got way too wild and claimed six casualties, one of whom is found in the shed by the meat people, as the coroner's crew refer to themselves. This Jane Doe gets to Edison, who shudders at the sadness of dying alone and unknown. Unlike most crime writers, not to mention most of their readers, who revel in the bloody aftermath of a violent encounter, the Kellermans show compassion for the survivors, including conscientious officials like Edison. Deep down, we know we're powerless, he admits. All of us, however, would like to imagine that we're contributing in some small way to keeping the world orderly. Then comes along a stark reminder to the contrary. Edison makes it his business to identify Jane Doe, find her killer, and restore the dignity she's been denied. The man got his flaws. A silk scarf decorated with a pattern of human skulls might not have been such a great birthday present for his wife. But he's got heart, caring not only for the lonely dead, but for the cops. They're living advocates. I knew what it was like to live with victims, to have them take up residence in your head, nameless, insistent, to carry on a conversation no one else can hear except us. If you can overlook the high body count, The Bouncer, published by Mysterious Press, $26, by David Gordon, is a brilliantly goofy caper novel in the grand tradition of Donald Westlake. A terrorist plot to hit New York City is the only threat that would make Confederates out of warring mobsters like Uncle Chen, who runs the Chinese street gangs in Flushing, Little Maria, who keeps the Dominican heroin trade cooking, Alonzo, who heads up the back gangs in Brooklyn, and Menachem Stone, who oversees the Orthodox Jewish underworld. We're all proud New Yorkers, patriotic Americans, whose families came from somewhere else, like Russia, Sicily, the Caribbean, Louisiana, fleeing poverty, says Giovanni Caprisi, the gangster known as Gio the Gent. But for all their professional expertise, hunting spies and defusing bombs aren't among the talents these tough folks have. Better they should hire a gangster sheriff like Joe Brody, a bouncer at Club Rendezvous who's carried out classified military missions during a stint in Special Forces. In a case like this, Brody is definitely your man. Ghosts in the attic and skeletons in the closet are bad enough, but nothing in the realm of domestic horror beats coming home to find total strangers in the process of moving into your home. That's the heartbreak Louise Candlish dishes out in Our House, published by Berkeley, $26. Fiona and Bram Lawson have separated, but Fiona and the children are still living in the red brick Edwardian at 91 Trinity Avenue in London until the day Fiona discovers that another family has taken possession. Bram, meanwhile, has skipped off to Switzerland with the money from the sale, leaving his wife to sob out her story on The Victim, a crime podcast that feeds on the misery of injured parties like herself. This terrific premise almost makes up for the fact that Fiona is such a pill and Bram is such a worm. As for the house, well, that's certainly worth a fight to the death. Imagine you're married to a handsome, charismatic teacher who's just been promoted to dorm master at an exclusive boarding school in New Hampshire. Now imagine that the students in Moreland Hall, informally known as the Slut Dorm, are located in a fierce competition to seduce their dorm master. If murder doesn't figure in your ruminations, it should, because that's what happens in She Was the Quiet One, published by St. Martin's, 2699. Michelle Campbell's cozy mystery with teeth and nails. Sarah Donovan finds herself in this awkward situation when she and her husband, Heath, are assigned to monitor the raging hormones of the rich, entitled, and unbridled Moreland girls. Among them are the 15-year-old twins, Belle and Rose Enright. Belle, the bold twin, is mad for Heath. Rose, the quiet one, becomes attached to Sarah. Despite the annoying flips and flops in storytelling time, what is it with this trendy stylistic affectation? The novel delivers a deadly crime, some surprising twists on said crime, and several suspects who need a good spanking. There's no mistaking a John Connolly novel with its singular characters, airy subject matter, and Sacco style. All these things are flying in The Woman in the Woods, written by Emily Bessler and published by Atria, 2699, which finds Charlie Parker, the oddball private detective in the quirky series, thwarted by the broken link in a chain of safe havens for battered women. Normally, they go in one end of the tunnel and out of the other, far away, except when one of them is caught. Someone like Karis Lamb, whose body is found in a shallow grave in the woods shortly after giving birth. There's no sign of her newborn child. A man named Quayle, who may very well be the devil himself, and his creative creepy Polita Moores commit some vividly depicted atrocities in their fevered hunt for a powerful ancient book, which they believe to be in Karis's possession. Parker himself is no saint. If there's trouble, he'll find it. If there isn't trouble, he'll make some. And it's best to stay away from him whenever he's visited by the black dog of depression. But he's a savior in a world that can be merciless to those without a champion. All the kinky people in this novel, killers included, are readers. Parker's pal Lewis, who has eclectic tastes, is currently juggling Montaigne and Hemingway. And when he wasn't reading, he was contemplating what he just read. Dobie of Dobie's Diner in Cadillac, Indiana, is also a rare book dealer who subscribes to the New York Times, the New Republic, National Review, and the New Yorker. What makes this dedicated reader a mensch, however, is his covert work as a principal in the Underground Railroad for frightened and abused women. Connolly creates a world somewhat real but emphatically unnatural, in which the dead commune with the living in mysterious ways. 5-year-old Daniel, for one, is no longer answering his toy telephone after receiving frequent calls from Karis's uneasy ghost. Daniel didn't want to talk to dead people anymore. Well, he can always talk to us. We're right here by the phone waiting. Get me out of here. Haven't we all at one time or another wanted to escape into a brand new unencumbered existence? Better keep that to yourself, Charlton Pettis warns in Exit Strategy, published by Hanover Square, 2698. Or somebody could whisk you off to a new life that might not be entirely to your liking. That's what happens to Jordan Parrish, founder of a medical technology company, when his business and his marriage hit the rocks. As Jordan sees it, he can either swallow a stash of pills or call a service that will scrub away his old existence and relocate him to some not-so-hard-to-take destination like Tokyo or Paris. While Petrus captures the excitement of waking up in a strange country with a lot of money in your pocket, the thrills are largely lost on Jordan, who could use a more unequivocal love of adventure, not to mention a keener sense of humor. You can't blame Charlie Dunlay if the ending of his novel makes your jaw drop. The title alone, Don't Believe It, published by Kensington, $26, is fair warning that his characters are no more to be trusted than are our initial impressions of them. This much do we know. In 2007, a vacationing medical student named Julian Christ was pushed to his death from the top of Rose Pitten on the Caribbean island of St. Lucia. Julian's girlfriend, Grace Siebold, has spent 10 years in prison for the murder when Sidney Ryan gets the green light to make a TV series about her called The Girl of Sugar Beach. Now here comes the twist. Sidney's documentary will follow in real time her personal investigation of the murder and will end, she hopes, in Grace's exoneration. But by the eighth installment of the show, which has been wildly successful, Sydney is beginning to suspect she's been deceived and that her great coup was actually a con job. On the one hand, her career could be mud, and on the other, you can't argue with those ratings. Uh-oh, baseball players with the Boston Red Sox are coming to the good, to no good, and Pamela Webster's new Abby Endicott mystery, The Fens, published by Minotaur, $27.99. And while a missing ball player isn't as serious a matter as losing the pennant to the Yankees, it still means war. Endicott, Boston's chief homicide prosecutor and the novel's narrator, is out and about in Back Bay with her boyfriend, Ty, when they're accosted by a stranger toting a Glock and demanding drugs. Turns out he's an overzealous cop, which has Abby mentally writing an outraged newspaper headline. African-American male attacked by rogue Brookline police officer while walking with assistant district attorney. That's the sort of thing Abby has to contend with in the enlightened metropolis she so diligently serves. But it's nothing compared with the old-fashioned fury that sweeps through the city when Rudy Maddox, the starting catcher for the Red Sox, fails to show up at Fenway Park for opening day. Abby has tacked other touchy cases in this lively series, but the Red Sox, come on. Inspector Ian Rutledge haunts Charles Todd's mysteries like an unhappy ghost, wandering among the living but more at home among the dead. In The Gatekeeper, published by Morrow, $26.99, the shell-shocked veteran of World War I is investigating a murder in Wolf Pit, a village that once served as a holding pen for trapped wolves. But by the winter of 1920, the place has evolved into a comfortable cage for trapped souls, notably the wounded veterans and grieving widows who make up much of this shrunken population. This wasn't the usual village murder, Rutledge wrote, when Stephen Wentworth, the proprietor of the town's bookstore, is shot dead by a stranger who accosts him as he's driving along a country road in the dark of night. According to a note left in the inspector's hotel room, Stephen Wentworth is a murderer. He got what he deserved. Not even his mother has a kind word for him. He was always a disappointing child, she tells Rutledge, and he grew into a disappointing man. Every decent detective feels obliged to bring about justice on behalf of a murder victim. Here, Rutledge is honor-bound to restore the good name of a young man who may not have been guilty of the homicide that even in death hangs over his head. And the only way to do that is to find the real killer. As always, in this singular series, the mother and son team, who write as Charles Todd, position their mystery within the broader context of a nation frozen in post-war depression. Viewing the world through Rutledge's eyes, we can't help noticing that there are very few able-bodied young men left in the village. Even young women are in scant supply, many having been lured to the cities by the well-paid work offered by factories in need of laborers, while the men were off on the battlefield. The melancholy tone that distinguishes the Rutledge series is a reminder that war never ends for the families and friends of lost loved ones. It just retreats into the shadows. Elvis Cole is the kind of private detective a woman would turn to if her teenage son started wearing a Rolex Cosmograph Daytona watch that retails for $40,000. In The Wanted, published by Putnam, $28, Robert Cray's superior specimen of tough guy hero rides to the rescue of a single mother, Devon Connor, who worried sick about 17-year-old son Tyson Cole, quickly determines that the kid is running with some crash-and-burn children whose wealthy Los Angeles parents have no idea that their offspring have committed a string of burglaries and are selling the goods at the Venice flea market. Unfortunately, a laptop they've stolen is worth money and human lives to someone who has sent a pair of hired guns to retrieve it. After they murder one of the young thieves, the other becomes Cole's headache. Craze writes choice dialogue for those hired guns, Harvey and Stems. In fact, their heated discussion about the shower scene in Psycho is so entertaining you wish they didn't have to go the way of all secondary characters in hard-boiled crime novels and, you know, die. Paradise, according to Frank Tallis in Mephisto Waltz, published by Pegasus, $25.95, is an exact replica of early 20th century Vienna, where chemical coffee houses, or where celestial coffee houses, line the principal approaches to the pearly gates. That would make angels of the psychoanalyst Dr. Max Lieberman and his friend Detective Inspector Oscar Reinhardt, the brainy sleuths in Talis's erudite series of historical mysteries. He seizes on the singular appeal of this period from the luscious Apfelmarn and Topfen Strudel served in the fashionable cafes to the lively intellectual discourse of their learned patrons. Viennese were so highly strung, so nervous, even symphonies got them agitated. A disfigured corpse discovered in the workshop of a derelict piano manufacturer leads to revelations about the city's dark side. An underworld of anarchists plotting to assassinate Emperor Franz Joseph, a woman who has built a bomb-making factory in her basement, makes a memorable appearance, as does Dr. Sigmund Freud, who advances the argument that a political party is just another form of crowd, and politicians are dangerous because they're buoyed up by the people who stand behind them, carried forward on waves of feeling. IKEA Jensen is nothing if not resourceful in the first novel in Sarah Bladel's new series, The Undertaker's Daughter, published by Grand Central, $26. Jensen leaves her home in Cape Copenhagen and flies to Racine, Wisconsin, after her estranged father leaves her an undertaking business in his will. On her first day, Jensen must add pet dogs to the plans for a funeral service, pick up a severely mangled body at the morgue, bring along some extra plastic, it sounds like it might be a mess, and come up with $60,000 to keep the IRS from freezing her assets. To make this new life complete, the police inform her that one of the bodies in her freezer is probably a murderer. Most amateur sleuths hold down professional jobs to support their unofficial detective work. Bladel has come up with an especially challenging occupation for Jensen, but this 6-foot-tall Viking goddess is strong enough to carry it all by herself. Where are the bodies? That's the pertinent question posed by Michael Cortia in his cool and cunning novel, How It Happened, published by Little Brown, $27, which is loosely based, he has said, on a murder he covered as a young reporter in Indiana. Perhaps because of the personal angle or just because Cortia is such a skilled writer, the story feels like the real deal. Rob Barrett, an agent with the Boston Division of the FBI, is dispatched to Port Hope, Maine, to work on an unusual murder case. A 22-year-old woman named Kimberly Crapeau has graphically described her involvement in a double homicide, and someone has to obtain an official confession. More to the point, Barrett must oversee the recovery of the two victims from the pond, where Kimberly claims that she and a friend dumped the bodies. They're down there between the raft and the deck, she explains. You'll find them there. I don't know how deep. They aren't down there very far, though. It's just dark water and a lonely place. You'll find them easy. That passage gives me goosebumps, a credit to Cortia's descriptive powers. It doesn't say much, though, for Kimberly's reliability, because despite multiple attempts by professional divers, no bodies can be found in the 24-acre pond. Barrett is something of an authority on interrogation methods, and since he has staked his reputation on his interviews with Kimberly, his job is suddenly in jeopardy, especially when two bodies turn up 212 miles away, wrapped in garbage bags and stashed in the woods. The Bureau rarely fires agents, a colleague reassures him unkindly. We just bury them. On a cold spring day in 1940, the war had come knocking on Rejavik's door. Arnadur Indrason gravely informs us in The Shadow Killer, published by Minotaur Thomas Dunn, 2699. A sober companion to the Shadow District and a continuation of the author's close scrutiny of his native Iceland when it was under military occupation. American troops have been sent to relieve the British garrison protecting this neutral nation, and United States counterintelligence agents are already billeted at the old leper hospital. This is no time for a little local murder, if that's all it is, when a traveling salesman is shot dead with a Colt 45 pistol, the weapon of choice for American GIs. Flovent, the only detective working for the city's criminal investigation department, teams up with a military police officer named Thorson to make what they can of the implacable hatred, the anger, the utter ruthlessness reflected in the execution-style murder. As translated by Victoria Cribb, Anderson's austere, clear-cut prose coldly reveals all the disruption the military occupation had brought to this sparsely populated island and its simple society. It's December of 1923 in Barbara Cleverly's charmingly old-fashioned novel, Fall of Angels, published by Soho Crime 2695, and everyone in England is celebrating in the happy knowledge that World War I is far behind them. Recalling the four Christmases he endured in the trenches of Flanders, Detective Inspector John Redfry of the Cambridge Constabulary is thankful to be spending this one at a holiday concert for organ and trumpet in the company of a more congenial German, Johann Sebastian Bach. Redfry's pleasure comes to an abrupt end, however, when someone shoves the gifted trumpeter Juno Proudfoot down the steps of the choir loft. She's unharmed, but an attack on another woman that same night proves successful, which puts a chill on the revels. Was this some upper-class loony loose on the Cambridge streets, someone wonders? Cleverly resolves the mystery with her customary expertise and good taste, but she's human enough to take the occasional jab at men who make the rules of society, smothering female talent, gagging and belittling their wives and daughters. Being faithful to the period, she also observes the social proprieties, inviting a female acquaintance to his cottage. Redfry worries about decorum. What he was doing was probably unlawful, he realizes, and most certainly morally unacceptable. Happily, that doesn't stop him. Time was every ambitious punk dreamed of making it in New York or London. But according to Malcolm McKay's gritty novels, the crime capital now is Glasgow. In For Those Who Know the Ending, published by Mulholland, $26. Martin Sivak, 31, short, stocky, and standing in a foreign country, realizes that the criminal contacts he made back in the Czech Republic aren't such big shots here. Unfortunately, the English he acquired watching American TV won't advance his current aspirations, and he's reduced to performing menial jobs for an absurdly hairy Polish guy. With a better command of the Queen's own English, McKay himself is a prose master who seems to take real pleasure in assigning a street-smart Pakistani named Usman Kassar to teach Martin the local lingo. It's even more fun watching cocky Usman struggling to pronounce a name like Prezimek Kurwazik. In the next group of stories, and I just have a little short time left, this is titled Love Notes, Romance, and they're reviewed by Jamie Green. Romance is both loved and derided for its formulaic nature. It is comfort, escapism, and reassurance in a troubling world. It is generic in the truest sense, a genre defined and constrained by a handful of conventions. The heart of every romance is a love story. And by the last page of the book, the lovers wind up together, happily ever after, or at least happily for now. Less codified, but no less crucial, is that no children or pets are harmed. This is a good place for happy endings, after all. These rules give rise to a rich variety of stories, but they are constraints nonetheless. Here are four recent books that either test the boundaries or occupy the essential core of what a romance novel is. A romance is more than a book with a love story. It's a book about a love story, and J.R. Ward's Consumed, published by Gallery Books, $26.99, edges right up to the wrong side of that line. But in the end, the love story is still the center of things, and what surrounds it is a complex world, a context that defines the central couple as much as their love does. The book opens with the firefighters Danny McGuire and Ann Ashburn battling a blaze in an abandoned warehouse. They have a long-standing flirtation and recently slept together for the first time. Here, the usual fodder for the first half of a romance is relegated to backstory. But there's still so much to cover. Their mission goes wrong, leaving Danny traumatized and Anne unable to be a firefighter anymore. A disappointing turn for readers excited for a firefighter romance that involves an actual female firefighter. 10 months later, Anne is working as an arson investigator, and Danny's making a right mess of his life, chasing a death wish on the job and off. After some particularly unsound decision-making, one of Danny's crewmates asks Anne to check in on him, which forces the two to grapple with their unsettled past and, of course, their intense attraction. At the same time, Anne's digging into an arson case with some dangerous, powerful people behind it. That case, Danny's friends, Anne's family, and the maneuverings of local politics all weave through the rest of the story. That less thoughtfully integrated are Ward's peculiar political asides. A hospital nurse is derided as a microaggression-sensitive millennial, despite the fact that Anne is surely a millennial herself, and some loafer-wearing bros display their knavery by telling a Latina waitress, they're going to report her to ICE. It's equal opportunity mockery, but pointless and distracting. But Anne and Danny's developing relationship is still central, even if it doesn't dominate. Most impressive, while Anne sees and understands Danny's trauma, she doesn't magically cure him of it. Nothing is easy or simple in this story, this love story. But it is realistically complex, even amid the TV drama levels of intrigue swirling around it. And that's all the time I will have for this week. I will read the rest of the romance novels next week.